due to countless many rebirths and reincarnations, tossed amid waves of my delusions, forced out of habituation to live along many lifetimes of negative imprints, I've collected so much karma that will definitely bring about many, many obstacles. Whether I sit alone at home, hiding from the world, many obstacles will arise. Or I go out into the world and do many activities, obstacles will arise. Obstacles will arise from the north, from the south, from the east, from the west, from up, from down, from the 10 directions. It will come consistently. It has come in the past. It is coming in the present. And more will come in the future. And the reason for obstacles to come in the form of disease, unhappiness, insecurity, depression, shortness of life, financial difficulties, disharmony, fear. It comes not from an outer force, not from an outer person, not from an outer situation, but it comes directly from my own creations of my mind. Therefore, I have been very fortunate to come across the Buddha's teachings, the historical Buddhas, the historical Buddha Shakyamuni, my refuge, my teacher, my guide, my example. Since I had the great fortune to come across the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, after so many lifetimes of wandering, and in this life alone of wandering, of distractions, of children, of marriage, of fun, of games, of entertainment, of sickness, of old age, all the things I've experienced in this lifetime that has brought me to where I am now, which is actually nowhere. May I not waste any more time on the trivial activities of this life, but engage in the study of Dharma, engage in the understanding of Dharma. When I understand, and only when I understand very well, engage in the meditation in order to subjugate my mind. Subjugate my mind from that of habituations that bring harm into habituations that bring benefit. During this spiritual journey, especially now during the modern material world, I encounter so many incredible obstacles. All these obstacles cannot be removed by any outer deity, as Lord Buddha has said. All these difficulties and sufferings that I encounter, and setbacks, inner meaning mental, sickness, disease, outer meaning from an outside source, cannot be removed or taken away by anyone, deity or human. They can only be removed by the application and the practice of Dharma, being aware of cause and effect, and living my life according to the actions that dictate cause and effect. Therefore, in my spiritual journey, when I come across so many obstacles, and at times it makes me want to give up, which is illusory. Why? By giving up, I increase and I ask for and I invite even more problems and difficulties. It is like saying, I have a disease, I don't wish to go to the hospital. Even not wishing to listen to Dharma teachings, even wishing not to go near a Dharma teacher or listening to Dharma teachings or getting involved in Dharma, but saying that I prefer meditation at home, or I prefer practice at home, or I prefer practice, is also illusory. Why? When the Dharma teachers are around, we should get as much teachings as we can. Meditation is for when the teacher is not around. Why? Meditation can only have results if the knowledge is there. Therefore, even aspiring to meditation or getting teachings, many obstacles arise in my mind, inner obstacles. What kind of obstacles? Laziness, distractions, friends, entertainment, which thwarts me and pushes me away from learning the Dharma. All these obstacles rain down like the summer monsoon. Although they are created by me, although I am the author of them, the enlightened ones, the Mahapanditas, the Mahasiddhas, and the great monks and scholars of ancient India who has held Buddha's teachings in their heart in the great monasteries of Bodh Gaya and the great monasteries of Nalanda, have taught immaculate ways in order that we may have a friend on our spiritual journey. In our search to find Buddhahood, in our search to find the Buddha within us, they have taught special and incredible methods that were revealed to those who are ripened and those who are ready. Today I will listen to the teachings and the practice and the lineage of the great Dharma protector, Setra. I will listen with the motivation that in order to alleviate obstacles for others and myself to increase the Dharma, inner increase and outer increase, I will listen with this type of attitude that I may be of tremendous benefit to others. My mind will be clear, my senses will be sharp, and I will focus my mind on what is going on to learn. I've entered a place of worship and learning and meditation, and I will engage in those actions while I'm here in listening, meditation, and learning. And when I leave this place, I will be enriched. Today, when I leave this place and I go home, I will be enriched, have more knowledge and more understanding, which will increase my actual meditation. And although sometimes the knowledge I acquire may not be applied to myself, if I listen with great compassion, I can share this knowledge with other people who might need this knowledge in the future. Knowledge was never wasted. So therefore, for the sake of others and myself, I will listen to tonight's talk, which was requested by the Kichara Media Publications Department, hosted by Kichara House, which all facilities are comfortable and easy for us to learn the Dharma. How kind all the organizers and all the people are to arrange all of this. And all the resources that have gone into today, how kind all of them are. I will listen for them, and I will dedicate the merits for them also. From the side of the teacher must give knowledge and explain to the best of his abilities, irregardless of how he feels, irregardless of his health, irregardless of his mental state, irregardless of his preoccupation, irregardless of whether it is his favorite subject or not. The teacher from the side must teach free of the 8 worldly dharmas, without any attachment to name or fame, without any attachment to get any type of monetary or physical or materialistic compensation or reward. The teacher himself must have a motivation that in order to benefit others who have a sincere motivation to aspire to Dharma practice, he will open his mouth, he will shuffle his knowledge, he will do research, and he will explain to the best of his ability with the purest of motivations, irregardless of how his body feels during teachings, irregardless of his mental state, and irregardless of whether it's his favorite subject or not. With compassion and skill, with love and great motivation that will benefit the listener, the teacher should transmit the Dharma to the listeners. The listeners at the same time should appreciate the teacher's effort and the abode, the place, and listen carefully. Therefore, the teacher and student both have good motivation with a good heart, then therefore it becomes Dharma practice. Then therefore, listening to the Dharma teachings become Dharma practice, equivalent to doing meditation. Equivalent to doing meditation. For meditation is not the 1 hour we sit on our cushions. It is the 23 hours off of the cushions is our real meditation. Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, good. Okay, these are what we're going to talk about tonight. The origins of Setra, the significance, his nature, his lineage from India to Tibet. How do we invoke upon him to help us? What are the actual prerequisites or necessities we need for him to actually help us? What can we expect from a Dharma protector? Why do we have a Dharma protector? Why are Dharma protectors so much emphasized in Northern Buddhism, such as China, Japan, Korea, Tibet, Mongolia, Nepal, in India? Why is it so much more stressed in the northern schools of Buddhism as opposed to the southern schools of Buddhism, such as Laos, Cambodia, Burma, Thailand, etc.? Okay, we're going to talk about these subjects. And some of the information I researched, some of the information I heard from different senior monks in Ganden Shaxin Monastery, but mostly I received from His Eminence Khenso Jamba Yeshe Rinpoche, the Grand Abbot Emeritus of Ganden Shaxin Monastery. And I think that was in 1998, as far as I remember. Okay. I think this one off. Quite cold. Thank you. We're going to talk about offerings, etc. We're going to talk about, if we have time, we're going to get into oracles. If we have time, I'm going to show you Setra Oracle and also the oracles of Tibet that is propitiated by His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama. So this is not a practice that is done among one or two little minor people or some monks or some monasteries. This practice is done from the highest to the lowest, to the ordinary, everyday persons. So I will show you some videos that I prepared. Just about 6 or 7 minutes of footage, because we don't have time for the whole thing, from His Holiness down to the monasteries of all sects that practice, and how these incredible protectors actually manifest in human oracles to talk and speak. I will show you. All right, so it's quite incredible. We have an exciting night ahead. Those of you who can be here tonight, you should be very, very happy. Some of you didn't want to be here. Some of you made other plans. Some of you maybe wanted to, maybe not. But whatever it is, you have the karma to be here, and I rejoice for you. So therefore, we're going to talk about the oracles, and I'm going to talk about a little bit into divination, because it's related. A little bit, not too much, because tonight it's not about that. Because in the future, there should be divination masters in our center, meaning people who can do divination without any monetary compensation. If divination is done with monetary compensation, then the power will be gone. The ability will be gone. Why? Because the deities that are contacted within the Tibetan context for divination are enlightened deities. Since they are enlightened deities, if you use their abilities to do actions that are bringing you more harm, then of course it will stop. So it's not a punishment, it is actually protection. Okay, so we're going to talk about that. And if I skip or miss anything, do remind me. So there's so much more brains out there than me, I'm sure I'll slip and forget, so one of you have to remind me and let me know. All right? And, okay. Now, Buddhism, as we all know, and surprisingly one or few people did know, originated from India. For some people who did know, Lord Buddha was Indian. And the place he was born, the place that he was raised, what is a disputed area now that some people consider Nepal, some people consider India, but in the ancient text we call it India. So during that time, it must have been a part of India. So anyway, that doesn't really matter. It's just borders made up by human beings. So what happens is, during Buddha's time, you have to understand, you're not dealing with an ordinary person. You're not dealing with an ordinary human being. You're dealing with a person whose body is of this world, but the mind is fully enlightened, fully enlightened. And what an enlightened mind can comprehend, what an enlightened mind can perceive and understand is beyond anything that we can ever even remotely grasp onto. So we human beings should not hold on to our conventions and projections and rules and regulations of what an enlightened being can and cannot do due to our limited hearsay, due to our limited knowledge, and due to our limited learning. Some people feel, oh, I'm very learned. So if I don't know that, it doesn't exist. Some people feel, oh, I've never heard that before. And some people feel, oh, but in my mind, that's not very clear. So it could not exist. That would be very, very damaging to oneself. Why? That would go into the assumption that oneself has the highest knowledge. There's no one else with knowledge beyond that. So that would be very limiting to oneself. So what happens is this is, we shouldn't think that the Buddha is very limited in what he can do, his body, his speech, and mind. The Buddha can appear in many places simultaneously and teach. The Buddha can appear in many guises to teach. The Buddha can teach many subjects simultaneously. Similarly, the Buddha can teach with one language, but it will penetrate and it will go to many, 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 many different minds. It will go to many, many different levels. And everybody in the group and everybody at that level will be able to understand and comprehend and absorb what he's saying at their level. Why? Because the Buddha has the power of speech. If you think that the Buddha must talk to you individually at your level, at your language, and at your intellect, then you limit Lord Buddha's abilities. You limit Lord Buddha's abilities. So you have to open your mind and realize Lord Buddha's abilities and speech is highly, vastly different than our own. So we shouldn't use our own mental limitations of how a Buddha may talk, act, function, do. And we should never, ever put the Buddha's actions or what a Buddha can and cannot do according to our culture and our own convention. When we do that, it creates a lot of misunderstanding. Sectarianism between different schools of Buddhism, sectarianism within the schools of Buddhism arises from our projections and our conventions and our culture and what we are taught that a Buddha can and cannot do. So if you have a Chinese monk go to Japan, a Japanese monk go to Korea, a Korean monk go to Mongolia, a Mongolian monk go to Vietnam, a Vietnamese monk go to Thailand, a Thai monk going to Laos, a Lao monk going to Tibet, a Tibetan monk going to America, an American monk going to England, an English monk going to Australia, Australian monk going to France, a French monk going back to Brazil, a lot of conflicts. Why? Each country will look at that monk and say, but that's not what I'm used to. What you're teaching, what you're explaining, and the way you pray, the way you chant, the way you look, your dress, your clothes, what you can and cannot do is not what I'm used to. And then the monks themselves, if they're not highly learned or practiced, they will look at the tradition and say, oh, that's wrong. My way is correct. That's not correct. That way is right. You should prostrate this way. You should chant this way. You should meditate this way. You should study this. The Buddha said that. The Buddha didn't say this. The Buddha said this. The Buddha didn't say that. Maybe Buddha said this, but not the way you think. All these conflicts arise. So sectarianism arises from what? People's black hearts? No. People's misguided projections of what they feel something should be or should not be according to their culture, according to what they're used to, according to the way they're brought up. So therefore, if we always base our understanding of something from our limited perspective, there will be a lot of damage. Hence, the northern schools and the southern schools debate. You hear criticism from the northern schools, you hear criticism from the southern schools of each other, of themselves, of others. Why? Lack of exposure, lack of understanding. But the Buddha didn't have any conflict. All the teachings practiced in the northern and southern schools of Hinayana, Theravadan tradition, there are many beautiful names. Amayana or Tantrayana, or around here they like to call it Vajrayana, is all stemming from Lord Buddha. Why? They have one common goal, enlightenment. They have different methods, but they have one common goal. Whether it's a Vajrayanist, whether it's a Theravadist, or whether it is a Mahayanist, their common goal is enlightenment. One. Second feature is in all three schools of Buddhism, their common method is meditation. Why? Meditation is rehabituating the mind to think another way. And therefore, when our meditation is successful, then our daily action and speech and action will be beneficial and less harmful to others and ourselves. Therefore, the elimination of karma and the purification of karma, habituation. Second, that's common in all three schools, which is meditation, the goal of enlightenment. In all three schools, it is well known that Buddha is not a savior, Buddha is not respected as a savior, Buddha is not looked upon as a savior, Buddha is not seen as a savior, but as an example, as a sage, as a teacher, as a being who has achieved what we wish to achieve. Like looking at a pilot and saying, when I grow up, I want to be a pilot. And admiring, respecting, showing courtesy, and learning and training under the pilot to become a pilot. So therefore, in all schools, all traditions of Buddhism, all schools, all yanas, whether it's Theravadan, Mahayana, Vajrayana, the goal is to become a Buddha. The method is by meditation. And to become skilled in meditation, study, learning, teacher relationship, student relationship, time, effort. Similarly, simply to sit at home and meditate and increase meditation is wonderful, is good, but that will not bring us to enlightenment. Why? Meditation needs to have a motive, it needs to have a method, and it has to have a dedication. It's very, very important. Therefore, simply meditating is very good, but not good enough. Therefore, what's more important is this, which is what I stressed before. Let's say one day a week for you people who haven't seen, we practice meditation approximately half hour, 1 hour. Let's just make it an even, rounded number of 1 hour. Let's say that one day we practice meditation for 1 hour. But what happens to the other 23 hours? What we do on our meditation cushion is just a reminder of how we're supposed to act for the other 23 hours. When we don't act according to our meditation, the other 23 hours, the 1 hour we're in meditation becomes wasted. Why? If we do 1 hour of meditation a day, it will not be strong enough and powerful enough and effective enough and neutralizing enough to transform the other 23 hours that we are talking, thinking, acting from habituations. So therefore, people think that when they're doing 1 hour of meditation a day or 2 hours, whatever it might be, that once they're off the meditation cushion, once they're off their cushion of meditation and practice and making offerings and incense, that they can act and talk and do and be as they like, because that day they've already done their spiritual practice. But I would like to counter that by saying no, definitely not. You see, when you're going to school to become a doctor, you're not a doctor. Once you leave med school and you start your practice, that's when you actually start to become a doctor and heal. But when you're in medical school, no. Meditation is like that, you're in medical school. So what I mean is, if you do 1 hour of meditation a day, or 2 hour, or 3 hour, that's not the important issue. The issue must be the time you are off the meditation. So in Vajrayana or Northern Buddhism, what is focused on is the meditation, but what is emphasized is the time off the meditation cushion. Why is that? That is when we collect the negative karma. That is when our habituations become strong. That is when our speech goes rampant. That is when our activities go rampant. That is when we collect negative or positive karma. Because when you're on the meditation cushion, the chances of you doing very negative things are very slim, except with the mind. Very, very slim. So therefore, if we think that making offerings every day, doing our prostrating to the Buddha, making incense offerings, and also sitting on the cushion and doing our sadhanas, or doing our chanting and doing our black tea, or actual meditation is enough to transform our mind, it will not be. It will be very, very slow. Why? Because when we're off the meditation cushions, what are we focused on? We're focused on money. We're focused on our desires, family. We're focused on entertainment. We're focused on drinking. We're focused on friends. We're focused on sex. We're focused on parties, clothes. We're focused on all of that. That is not bad. That is not good. The point is, the amount of time we focus on indulgences is much more than the time we focus on spiritual evolution. Therefore, the 1 hour we do every day will never be enough to counter everything else. Hence, the tradition of Sangha arose. To become ordained as a monk or nun means to focus 23 hours a day on your meditation, 23 hours a day holding your vows and commitments and practice, and 1 hour a day perhaps cooking or cleaning or getting your room ready or laundry or whatever. That's the whole opposite direction. So what's my point? My point is, in Vajrayana practice, there are practices that all activities you do are in meditation. Whether you're eating, whether you're sleeping, whether you're walking or driving, or you're with your family, or you're watching TV, or you're reading, it can become a meditational practice. There are incredible practices. They're called Yidam practices, or the Anuttara Yoga tantric practices taught by Lord Buddha that totally transform your reality. Why? Because in Vajrayana Buddhism, the concern and emphasis is a time off the meditation cushion. Why? Because that time is more. Example, one day, you spend 1 hour on your meditation. But in 1 month, one day, it's 23 hours off the meditation cushion. Similarly, in 1 month, you spend 30 hours in meditation, approximately. But 690 hours doing everything else. Then in 1 year, you spend 360 hours in your meditation. But 8,280 hours outside of meditation. So what would be more powerful, this side or this side? Simply due to investment of time. Then, most of us in this room, when we discover Dharma, if we are very lucky, we can practice sincerely and wholeheartedly from the depths of our understanding for maybe 30 years, 40 years, more than that, very difficult. Due to old age, due to meeting Dharma late, due to distractions, due to interruptions, whatever, whatnot. So the most 40 years. Let's do a roundabout estimation. In 40 years, the Dharma practice we have done approximately is 14,400 hours. Whereas in 40 years, eating, sleeping, relationship, fun, entertainment, washing, watching our kids, getting old, getting young, anything that we do that doesn't help us in any way, we spend 331,200 hours we spend. So in 40 years, the actual Dharma practice that we're doing, that's if our meditation is concentrated and focused, is 14,400 hours. But the time we spend for everything else that actually in reality, no offense, is a waste of time, is 331,200 hours. What do you think will have a more stronger karmic effect on you? Your spiritual evolution, your enlightenment, your death, your bardo and your rebirth. What do you think will have a stronger effect? This or this? If you spend 14,400 hours a year on your job to make money, or I'm sorry, if you spend 360 hours a year on your job or 8,280 hours a year on your job, which one do you think will produce more money? If you spend 360 hours on a relationship or 8,280 hours on a relationship, which one do you think will bring better results in your relationship? So you can apply that to anything in your life. If you spend more time on things that do not matter at the time of death at all, then those actions are not negative or positive, but they don't bring benefit. You see, there's no judgment here. There's no pointing fingers. There's not saying that you're doing this and this is bad or good. It's not. It's just factual. Totally factual. So in Vajrayana practice, what they're concerned about, this is very important. 1 hour a day, 330 hours a month, 360 a year, 14,400 in 40 years. In Vajrayana practice is very important. But even more important in Vajrayana practice is this side. 23, 690, 8,280, 331,200. If we casually say, oh, never mind. Next life I do this, next life I do this, next life I do this. You don't even know what's going to happen to you tomorrow. You're not even sure what's going to happen to you next year. Then how do you know what's going to happen to you in your next life? So if we casually throw spiritual practice aside, and we casually throw spiritual commitments aside, and we just make it a joke, we make it fun, never mind, next year, next month, next day, next week, then we'll be in for a very, very abrupt and rude awakening. Why? As I said, if we don't even know what we're going to do tomorrow, what will happen to us? A car accident? Sickness? Sudden death? Even as we sit right now, some of us are ticking health time bombs in our body, ticking away. Ticking means what? It's an insinuation that it will come to an end. Our bodies will come to an end. Even this very moment we're sitting here, we are ticking, walking health time bombs. That any moment from stress, from karma, from accident, from the disease arising, or one of the four elements going off, that something will come out that will disturb our life or create death. Any moment. This last year, almost every 2 to 3 months, one of my friends or one of their friends died. Every 2 to 3 months, there was a funeral this past year. Past year doesn't mean the calendar 2006 to 2007. I'm talking about the last 12 months. There's been a death. One day soon, we're even going to say in this room, hey, who died? Oh my God, we need to do prayers. Oh, we need to go to so-and-so's funeral. Why are we an exception? One day soon, we're even going to say, who has died in this group? Who is not here anymore? Who cannot attend anymore? Who cannot be here anymore? One day soon, we're going to hear that. When that time is approaching, what do you think is most important? To put our spiritual practice aside? Then we say, but my wife is very important. My wife is very important. My wife is very important. My husband, my kids, my friends. We always use that as an excuse to say that's very important. But actually, that type of person is not bad. They're ignorant. Why? You're not helping your wife by only focusing on material help, love, and gains. Why? Because when your wife and your husband and your kids, or after you've gone, nothing can help them. Or when they're dying and they're going, nothing can help them. You see, I have to do funerals quite often. And I go and talk to the families. I'm talking to you from experience. I'm talking to you from when they close the door and they tell me what their fears are. I have to often in the past go see people who are dying or who are on near death. And I listen to their fears and I listen to what they say. And I tell you, they usually say, I'm afraid what will happen to me after I've died. Usually. And this is not Chinese or Malaysian. This is everywhere in the world. I even have people emailing me. They're terminally ill, terminally sick. They have 6 months to 1 year. What can they do with themselves now? The difference between them and us is they know, we don't know. But we can go before them. So we use job and making money and family and kids as an excuse to delay our Dharma practice. It's a valid excuse for people who are our level, who only think that. But it wouldn't be a valid excuse for the ultimate truth, from people who have wisdom and who know more. Why? Because at the time of death, all these things that you treasure so much and you love so much and you're attached to will not be able to help you. How much do we work toward keeping our husband? How much effort and body and sacrifice and time and energy and thinking and money we put toward keeping our husband, keeping our wife? But in the end, they will have to be abandoned. So what is the purpose here? The purpose or goal here is, why don't we strike a balance? Why don't we strike a balance? If we really love our wife, if we really love our kids, if we really love the people that we claim we love, we have to help them beyond this life. And the only way to help them beyond this life is if we have some attainments and we can dedicate our practice and merits back to them. If we can dedicate our merits back to them, or we have practice that can teach them a better method, it will help them. If we do spiritual practice, do you know how much that will influence our wives, our husbands, our friends, our kids? You know, our kids are watching us. Our kids are growing up. How do you know that? Think when you were younger, all the things you observed that your parents did, good and inverted commas bad. And when you grow older, you're able to think. You respect them, but you also know that they're humans when they grow up. But when you were kids, they were devas or titans to you. Everything they do is without mistake. But when you grow up, you can see reality. My point is what? Is when you go, this life you have spent so much time and energy and money investment for your kids. If they don't have the karma, according to Lord Buddha, to enjoy, to receive, to keep, or to have, when you're gone and you can't protect them, they're finished. There are many, many kids that I have met from wealthy families that end up very, very bad situations. Very, very bad. There are many people I've met that children from very poverty-stricken backgrounds, with respect to them, end up very good due to attitude. And vice versa. Rich to good, also bad, poor to bad. Many types. My point is what? Is whether our kids fare well or not is not dependent totally on what we give them, such as education or money. It is example. The example of our Dharma practice. If we do Dharma practice, if we put Dharma practice in our mind, and we show priority to our Dharma practice, that will be the message we send our kids. Don't think, oh, they're too young, or they don't know, or they don't understand. They're not stupid. Everything is registered. And when we leave behind, when we are dead, and we really love our kids, if we really, really love our kids, we will leave Dharma practice behind, along with money or education, whatever we'd like to. But why? If we give them Dharma practice, they will have a method to be happy. And they will know how to protect themselves. And they will know how to think and function and act and be good human citizens. If we only think about money and material things and food and taking care of them, what's the point? Animals can do that. If we look at ourselves, we're becoming wrinkled. We're becoming drained, dried. All this is going to our kids. All this is going to our kids. We lose our bodies. We destroy our health. All for kids. And then we like to romanticize that by saying, oh, you know, but I love my kids. I like this. Yeah, your neighbors might say yes who don't know any better than you. But the truth of the matter is your attachments create even more suffering and problems. In Buddhism, if you want to go to the highest level of thought, kids and family is not something to be very proud of. It's not something to advertise. It's not something to say, wow. It is an extension of your sexual desire, your lust, your greed, your attachments to me. If I have kids, it will further my lineage. If I have a wife, I will have company, I will have sex, I'll have fun, I'll have whatever. If I have a husband, I'll have security, I'll have whatever. Actually, in higher Buddhist thought, where people are ready, these types of things, such as business, is an extension of greed. Wives and husbands is an extension of one's grasping ego thinking. Having these will bring security. Kids are open advertisement of our lust and our desire. And to use job, kids, business, family as an excuse not to do Dharma practice to normal people who don't understand anything. They'll say, yeah, that's a very valid reason. But if you think about it in a higher way with wisdom, it is actually a shame. Why is it a shame? I have family commitments, I can't do Dharma. I can't get involved, I can't help. I have to make money, so I can't do Dharma. I can't practice, I can't meditate, I can't get involved. I have kids, therefore I can't do it. Actually, it's a shame. Why? You may be saying it to the other person, but you're reinforcing something in you, which is the ego. Those are not things to be proud of. If they were to be proud of, Mother Teresa and His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Lord Buddha and Jesus would have all had families and kids. They would have all focused on them. Why do we look at them as examples, but we practice the opposite or think the opposite? So my point is what? If we have kids, okay, that's the result of our karma. We have it. So do we abandon them? No, of course not. Of course not, no. But we need to already divide our time to what is important. And we need to be realistic. And we need to be deciding those decisions based on wisdom and knowledge, not on hearsay, samsara, culture, or upbringing, or habituations. We cannot base it on that. So therefore, having kids and using that as an excuse not to do Dharma practice is contrary to what the Buddha has taught. Why? You're saying, because of this desire and this result, I'm not going to do it. In fact, your kids take you away from Buddhahood. Your kids take you away from practice and Dharma. Takes you away from freedom and health and pursuit of spiritual development. It takes you away. The reality is that your jobs do the same thing. Your wife does the same thing. Your husband does the same thing. Your relationship does the same thing. Your business does the same thing. Everything does the same thing. Why? Because when you are dying, you won't even be able to feel the person touching you anymore. When the earth element in you dissolves, even the person you have slept with and lived and ate with your whole life, your mother, your beautiful mother, your beautiful father, your children, your wife, your husband, whoever those people are, even when they touch you, you won't be able to feel it. Medically, that's correct. According to meditation, that's correct. You won't even be able to feel it. And you will start losing sight. When the wind element goes, you will start losing your hearing. Even when they talk to you, you won't be able to hear. You won't be able to see. And then you will feel cold when your fire element goes. And when your water element goes, thirst. Vision goes. The vision dries. Thirst comes. Feeling of sinking. All these feelings will come to you in a process of death. All these feelings. And nobody in this room is an exception. Whether you're a high lama sitting on a throne with that label that you're a high lama sitting on a throne, or you have a label you're not a high lama sitting on a chair or the floor, that's just a label. It will happen to every single person in this room. And when that happens, and you look back at your life, what did you do? What is the sum of your life? A few kids? Some thousands of dollars in the bank? An inheritance? You had a wife? You had a husband? You had a nice house? Is that the sum of your life? Is that what you want to leave behind? Is that what you want to leave behind for them and yourselves? Is that criticism? No. I say all of this to all of you with the deepest respect. I'm a Dharma teacher. I have to teach the Dharma, even if what I explain to you goes against your conventional thoughts. If I'm afraid to speak this, it would mean that I'm very selfish. It means that I am not teaching Dharma, that I'm actually just trying to make friends with you. So I don't say any of these things to disrespect any of you or what you have done or to criticize or to point fingers. No, 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 no. I'm a Dharma teacher. That's my job. That is my job. To tell you the truth with respect, clearly, logically, with the deepest hope that something will go in and activate some karma we have received from praying or meditating in this life and previous lives so that we can make a change before it's too late. That is my job. Dharma teachers become the most unpopular people. You think they become popular people? No, they become the most unpopular people because they tell people what they don't want to hear. Dharma teachers get threatened. I've got threatened many times, physically threatened. Dharma teachers get a lot of obstacles traveling. Dharma teachers have a lot of trouble starting things, getting help. Dharma teachers have a lot of obstacles convincing. And Dharma teachers make the most enemies. Why? Because they tell people the truth. And sometimes it takes time for people to absorb the truth. And they do many, many different types of avoidance techniques to not hear and listen because it's very painful. So therefore, instead of attacking the pain at the source, they attack the Dharma teacher. Verbally, threats, or saying that is not good, or the lineage is wrong, or what they're teaching is not applicable. They do many, many. Some even avoid Dharma teachers, or avoid the Dharma center, say, I don't want to go. Or some don't want to go and not listen, and rather stay home, watch TV. Why? What they listen to is very painful. I'm not here to create pain. If you're sick and you go to the doctor and he touches your body parts and he takes tests and pokes you with needles, it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt because that pain will go away from with healing applied. So therefore, in Dharma teachings, it's quite painful. Why? It touches something even more sensitive than our bodies, our mind. So the point of what I'm saying is motivational. The amount of time that we spend for actual happiness and the creation of happiness through positive karma, the actual time we spend to actually dedicate to the people we love, the actual time that we spend to actually bring benefit to others that we love, is maybe an hour a day. Maybe 2 hours. Some of us like to meditate 3-4 hours, but we can check our meditation. Meditation is not sitting on a cushion and feeling great bliss and happiness and your focus. Meditation is that you gain the abilities to be of more benefit to others, and your attachment to work, to money, to sex, to fun, to entertainment becomes less and less and less and less and less, and your spiritual practice becomes more. That is the object of meditation. What else can it be? Proof? Lord Buddha. As he meditated more and more, what level did he reach? Did he have more wives? Did he give up the Bodhi tree and go back to his wife? Proof is Lord Buddha. The aim of meditation. That is a real aim. So what happens is this is, even some people, when you even talk to them about meditation, they have resistance. Why? It's very scary for them to focus within. They're very used to looking for distractions without, outside. So what happens is this is, if we're spending 23 hours a day off the meditation cushion and wondering why the pujas are not effective, our prayers and sadhanas are not effective, our mantras are not effective, the tantras are not bringing effect, then that's your answer. Because if it's 1 hour a day, to 23 hours you're not practicing. What are we doing with the other 23 hours? Fast forward yourself to old age and to death. Fast forward. Why should you fast forward? That's what we're taught in the southern schools of Buddhism. That's what we're taught in the northern schools of Buddhism. In the northern schools of Buddhism, the monks are encouraged to go to the cemeteries to meditate. And in Ganden, we have a cemetery very nearby. There are senior monks who actually daytime sleep, and nighttime they go to the cemeteries. They walk out, we see them. They walk out to the cemeteries, they sit there, and they meditate the whole night. And in the morning, when dawn breaks, you see them walking back. And they come to puja, they receive their tea and their bread, they eat that, then they go to sleep. I've seen it many times. In the southern tradition of Theravada Buddhism, the monks are very wonderful. They actually have skulls or bones, or they live in temples where they have crematoriums, or they actually store the bones to pray for people, and they actually meditate in front of skulls or meditate in front of the bones. Why? Gruesomeness? No. Reality. Reality of what? Of our destiny. And if our meditation on the skulls and the bones are effective, we will see our attachments and anger and our frivolities become less and less and less and less and less. Why? Simply meditating, spending 1 hour, is kind of like sitting by the sea and looking out to the ocean and relaxing your mind. What's the point? Western meditation, Western New Age people, I've heard some, not all, say, oh, meditation relaxes me, brings my blood pressure down, I'm happy and I recharge and I feel very spiritual. That's not what it's about. That's not spiritual practice at all. That's just a New Age escape method to find more pleasure for the senses, or to regenerate the senses to get more pleasure. Why? There's a little burned out. They're a little burned out. They're a little stressed out. So they use meditation to rejuvenate their senses so they can go and enjoy more sensory pleasure. That's not spiritual practice at all. So a lot of new age things that I've seen, or I've heard, I've met, I've talked to, I've seen on the net, whatever, are people say, oh, I'm meditating. I'm meditating. My blood pressure goes down. I feel rejuvenated. I feel happier. I feel better. I feel much more relaxed. And so when I go and take care of my kids, I'd be more effective. When I go and work, I can make more money because I can make better decisions. And when I go out to parties and stuff, I have more energy to stay longer to entertain clients. And they say, you know, isn't that the purpose of meditation? And I'm so spiritual. And you look at them and go, why? The whole purpose of meditation is not to get more energy so you can have more parties, or you become more virile, or you can have more energy to make money, or that your mind is clear so that you know how to outwit your colleague. That's not the purpose of meditation. Buddha didn't teach that. That is new age people using meditational techniques for another wrong end. Why? Because they don't have a Dharma teacher. They don't have a guide. They're not bad. They're not bad. And if you hear that many times, I don't know about other countries, but in America, it is rampant and prevalent. When they talk about meditation, it is associated with health, focus, energy, rejuvenation, nothing about developing higher qualities, nothing about developing more positive qualities, nothing about tolerance, nothing about looking at things from a different perspective so the tolerance grows. It's more about more energy for sensory pleasure. And that is not the purpose of meditation. Two types of meditation. One is for gaining insight, that your mind becomes very focused in the northern and southern traditions. Your mind becomes very focused, either using the breath, using an object, or using a tantric deity. Why? When you bring your mind to the breath, you can carry that with you everywhere. It's in your body. You have to breathe. It's very easy. You can do that in the forest, you can do it at home. It's very easy. Because in the northern tradition of Vajrayana, breath meditation is very prevalent. And there are special types of breath meditation, especially associated with the six yogas of Naropa or Vajrayogini. Very powerful. That totally transforms and heals your body. The southern tradition has that too. Why? That all came from Lord Buddha. But you see, if you meditate on your breath, it is an object that's inanimate, that is not a Buddha, it's not anything except a method. If you meditate on your breath, it is to develop one pointed concentration. And that concentration is to be increased where awareness increases and increases to the point where you actually can recall minute details. Your senses become very clear. That itself is a tool for analytical meditation. And when your senses become very clear, your eyes, your ears, your thoughts become very clear, and your memory becomes very sharp, it is a tool. It is not an end. It is not an end. It is a tool. And people become misguided by that. People who reach higher levels of Vipassana meditation, they even see lights. Definitely. They feel very calm. They can stay in meditation for hours, some for days. That's wonderful. But that's not the purpose of that meditation, because there are meditators in Tibet who can stay in meditation 10, 15, 20 days, not moving, in great bliss. Happiness. They don't even need to eat. Half. There's nothing amazing. Nothing. Why? Bears can hibernate a whole season without eating, without moving, without doing anything negative or killing. Bears can do that already. So if we just use the holy Vipassana meditation, simply that we can sit there for 10 hours, 12 hours in bliss, we're just basically a mini bear. What's the point? So to show off to people and say, oh, I do meditation and I don't have to eat and I can stay focused and my mind's very happy. That's wonderful. For stupid people like me, we feel very happy. We go, wow. But to the great masters, they go, oh, let's go to the next level now. You've developed a tool, not an end. So when we focus on a Buddha, when we focus on an enlightened being for the same meditation, the object of your mind is to hold it on an object so it doesn't move. The object is not the point. Southern tradition uses breath. Northern tradition uses breath and or different deities. The different deities in their color and their arms and their eyes correspond to different psychological symbolism within our own body, developed by the Buddha. So therefore, if we concentrate on Lord Buddha to develop that, that will be more virtuous than just the breath. Why? Because when we focus on Lord Buddha, Lord Buddha's an enlightened being, we can gain merits, as opposed to just the breath. I'm not criticizing the breath. I'm telling you there are different methods for different people. So like that, doing offerings daily is wonderful. Offering incense is wonderful. Offering water offerings to the Buddha is wonderful. Making prostrations every day is wonderful. Doing some meditation on the breath or tantric meditations is wonderful. That's all wonderful. But most of us don't exceed an hour, inverted commas. Most of us don't exceed, put it very low. Most of us don't exceed more than 1 hour. So what happens to the other 23 hours? The result of meditation, the other 23 hours should be, we take care of our kids if we have them. Sorry to say, we don't think about having more. We take care of our responsibilities and pay our bills. We take care of what we need to do that we've already dug our own hole. We've dug our own hole. You know, in Tibetan tradition, monks never go to weddings. Never. If a monk attends the wedding, it's inauspicious for the couple. Why? Their purpose is the opposite. One is renunciation. One is what? So monks are never invited. And women and men never wear maroon cloth for any wedding outfit. Any. Why? The maroon cloth represents monkhood. In the southern tradition, it's saffron. What's the difference? It just means monkhood. So monks never go to weddings. They're never invited to weddings. They're never invited to participate. What happens if need be, the couple will come to the temple and become blessed and given advice on moral practice and ethical practice and how to take care of each other and to increase good activities. And they'll do a ceremony to bless them and then send them off. They actually don't go for the wedding, they don't go for the parties, they don't go for anything. Why? It's opposite. In the past, I got invited to a lot of weddings, which I turned down. People say, oh, why Rinpoche so cruel? The happiest time of my life, you don't want to join in. And he's so important to me. I said, I do want to join in, but I don't want to ruin it. I don't want to bring bad luck to you. They say, how can you bring bad luck? I said, well, what do I represent? What do you represent? They say, well, that's true. But in Tibetan tradition, monks never go to that, never get involved. It's completely opposite of the Judeo-Christian thinking. Judeo-Christian is that marriage is sanctioned by God. That it's a holy thing. That have kids is holy. I was wondering why all the animals don't get married either, because it's pretty holy, their kids. But my point is what? It's different views. So the 1 hour a day we spend in meditation is wonderful, and I'm not knocking it down. If that's all you're doing right now, you should consider increasing it. That's why for some of us to sit on a meditation cushion is very difficult. Very, very difficult. That's why I encourage people. We have so many departments to get involved with the Dharma. Whether it's a committee, whether it's fundraising, whether it's cleaning, whether it's activities, whether it's organizational, whether it's support, whether it's protection, whether it's increase of the center, whatever it is, we should commit and do. Why? Meditation in action. Action. To say I can't meditate and at the same time I can't get involved in Dharma is just an excuse. It's an excuse for what? To indulge. If we indulge, do we go to hell? No. If we indulge, are we a bad person? No. But will it bring us to higher states of rebirth or positive rebirths? That is also a no. That is also a no. So we have to think logically. For the last how many years, why are we not enlightened? Why is it our mantras don't have power? Why is it our sadhanas don't have power? And people do that. People say that. I've heard people say it many times. They come to Buddhism for a quick fix. They do their sadhanas and prayer for a quick, instant transformation. Doesn't happen like that. Even Lord Buddha didn't have an overnight transformation. According to the sutras, 3 countless aeons of meditation, of continuous practice, life after life. It wasn't in just one life. It wasn't in just one life. So, and Buddha, I think, spent all this, not like us. So if we spend this instead of this, what do you think our result will be? You think about it. If we spend all our time on this, what do you think our result will be? More anger? More backlash when people tell us things we don't like? More greed? More desire? More regrets? more negative karma? If our time is mostly in this, you think about it. Then you say, but I can't help it. Yes, you can't. You put yourself in it. So how? Meditate. Not on just your breath. Meditate on your body failing. Meditate on your timing, your ticking time bomb. Meditate, fast forward on your death. Meditate on being buried inside a coffin or being put inside a funeral pyre. Meditate on that. I do that. Meditate your body being burned step by step and seeing it melt. Meditate on the person closing your coffin. Meditate on the people weeping around you. Meditate on the ground you will be buried in. Meditate on your body turning into ash. Why do you meditate on that? It will help you to live better. Why will it help you to live better? How many people, when they have near-death experience or almost died in an accident, when they come out of it, they're such lighter and better and more easier people? Why? Because they value their life much more. That's a fact. Many people who have tragic accidents, when they come out, they're lighter, they forgive easier, they're more sweeter, they're more kinder to people around them. Even their evil, ugly minds just melt away. Even people that they don't like, just they let go. Why? They realize what's important. That's just a normal. That's a normal person. So when you meditate on death, when we meditate on death, not just the reality of it, but the actual details of it, you choose. When you die, would you like to be buried or burned? You choose. You're going to have to. You're going to have to. It sounds gruesome. Why is it gruesome? It's going to happen to you. Why avoid it? Why be scared of it? You're scared because you're not prepared. You're not prepared because you haven't put the time into it. So if you haven't put the time into it, you're going to be scared. If you're going to be scared, that should be a signal for you to do more. So by not doing the death meditation because you're scared, then you avoid the truth. When you avoid the truth will come. When the truth comes to you and death comes knocking, what do you do? Do you want to spend the rest of your life making money, raising kids, running around different countries and romping around different hotels and eating and sleeping and defecating and taking a nice bath and looking out a window? Is that all? How to counter that for modern people? How to counter? Meditate on the details of death. Detailed. Detailed. Why? Because that will happen to you. Why do you meditate on it now? To counter all your fears. How do you counter your fears? By meditating on death. How? Because when you meditate on death correctly and well, it will motivate you to do things that will make you not afraid of death anymore. That is Dharma practice. That is the truth. Some of you say, thank you, Rinpoche, for telling me that. Some say, I never saw it that way. And there are one or two people saying, what's the point? There's even a few people in the audience thinking, please don't talk about this. I'm quite scared. What's the truth? The truth is, if you're scared, it means you're not prepared. If you're not prepared, what in life have you not prepared yourself for? There are many things. Sometimes when you go for your job, sometimes when you go for your first date, all that stuff, you're scared. But if you prepare yourself, it's much easier. Why do you prepare yourself for everything else, but you don't prepare yourself for the ultimate? Why don't you prepare yourself for the ultimate? Do you think getting a job somewhere, another outer station somewhere, and then you make money and just live in a house, is that the purpose? It's like an animal, just eating and sleeping, eating and sleeping. Do you think that's it? When the Dharma's in front of you, when your Lama's in front of you, when the Dharma Center's in front of you, when the Dharma's alive in front of you, and you run away from the Dharma, to indulge more in money, in fun, and exercise, and in all types of things that doesn't help you. Why doesn't it help you? Because when you meditate on death, are you scared? There will be a few people that says, oh, I'm not afraid of death. They're just silly and stupid. Why? Some people are not afraid of what they don't know what's going to happen. Kids are not afraid of a lot of things. They walk in traffic, they're not afraid what? They're not afraid of getting run over by a car and getting killed. They don't realize it. So kids running in front of traffic and they're not afraid doesn't mean there's not something to not be feared. It just means they don't know. They don't know. So similarly, what's this session about? This session is about Setrap's practice. What does what I have to say have to do with Setrap's practice? If you meditate on what I say and then you do Setrap's practice, it will be very effective. Why? How does Setrap protect you? Setrap protects you. Why? People think Setrap is supposed to give you money and love and relationship. Satrap's lower activities is that. Satrap's higher activities is to actually push you towards Dharma practice. That when you do Satrap's black tea more, and you do Satrap's prayer more, and you do Satrap's mantra, and you commit yourself to Satrap, you know what his job is, according to Khyentse Rinpoche, Lathi Rinpoche, Khyentse Khunchu Tsering Rinpoche, according to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in regards to Dharma protectors. When you do Satrap more, your spiritual practice grows more. Doing meditation becomes a pleasure. Engaging in Dharma activities become a pleasure. Why? It will be pleasurable to prepare for death. It will be pleasurable to bring happiness to others and help them. It will be pleasurable to have a good rebirth. It will be pleasurable that in this life we let go of things that we indulge in that bring no happiness at all. That's real Satrap practice. People thank me, oh, I got a nice job because of Satrap. I say, wonderful. But then I wait for them 1 year, the next year. Do they come back to say to me, oh, I've let go of my enemy, or I've become a better person, or my speech has improved because I practice Satrap? Very rarely, almost none. Why? Because our perspective of religion and why we enter is wrong. The reason we enter religion is wrong. Because we enter religion wrong, the result will not come 100%. It's wrong. Therefore, Satrap's real job is that if we're going to go out to the pub and our friends are calling us and there's a Dharma teaching going on, or there's a meditation, or there's some activity going on that can benefit, that we can use that to dedicate to our parents or people that we love. By doing Satrap's mantra and practice, we will focus on a Dharma activity and say, never mind, to the pub. Satrap's practice is not for you that on the way to the pub you don't have a car accident. Why would you pray to Satrap that on the way to the pub you don't have a car accident, so when you get to the pub you can create more causes for a car accident, which is being drunk? Why would you pray to Satrap to get a beautiful girl so you can have 3 kids, 2 kids, 1 kid, and use your whole life and drain your energy and your body and your resources for these kids, and you end up dried up like a prune, nothing left, just waiting for death? Why would Satrap help you towards that? If people pray to Satrap to get a relationship, wrong person to pray to. Satrap won't thwart you, but he will give you wisdom. He'll direct you toward the teachings. Oh, yes. If you pray to Satrap that you can get $1 million, but with Satrap's third eye, he can check that with $1 million, you'll go away from the Dharma, you'll become arrogant, you'll become haughty, maybe you start to drink, maybe wrong friends come, maybe wrong crowd comes, attracts you to the wrong thing, and you do more and more negative things, Satrap will make sure you don't get your $1 million. Oh, that's not a joke. Because some people, they do Satrap practice, their business goes up. Some people, their business never moves. Why? It is a sign that if they get it, they will go down even further. But they don't understand that. They complain to me. Why? Why doesn't Satrap help me? Why I'm not getting this? Why I do pujas, I do prayers, I do mantras? Why? Then I don't want to tell them the truth, which is, thank God you didn't get it. Why? You'll only use that to harm yourself even more and the people around you, and set a bad example for the people around you that you can influence. That is the truth. That is the truth. And until we realize that, he won't help us, inverted commas, to get that. Why would Satrap help you to increase your sufferings, increase your indulgence, increase your negativities, increase your activities that help you to bring more negative karma? Why would Satrap do that? Then you pray to Satrap that your friend's business goes down and your business goes up. Yeah, there are people that pray that. Why? There are even people who pray to Satrap that their enemies will get harmed or be eradicated. It will never happen. Why? Because that will create more negative karma for you. Negative karma, definitely. Some people even pray that their kids will finish school. Let me tell you something. Let me tell you the truth. In some people's cases, when you pray to Satrap, you're blessed that your kid doesn't finish school. Why? In some kids' cases, if they finish, their destiny will lead to something very harmful, or meet people that's very harmful. Ultimately, what do we want for our kids? Our projection of what their happiness should be, or them to be happy? Do we want our projection of what makes them happy, or their happiness? That's why there's this thing called tukul disease. If there's a reincarnation and the parents stop the kids from learning, their kids will not go far in the future. Definitely not. Definitely not. Why? They're blocking their karma. It's negative karma for the kids. It's negative karma for the parents, negative karma for the kids. If they're real reincarnations, or they're real spiritual beings, and they're forced to just learn, go to school, they're forced to just get married or have a good time or just all that. Then you say, oh, never mind, if they're real, they reach a certain 18 or 19, they can do what they want, they have their own mind. Not necessarily, because they're a different level of tukuls. They're very high level tukuls, very high level. No matter what obstacles you put towards them, they will aspire to become a Dharma practitioner. The low level ones, few lifetimes of practice only. If you put the wrong influence on them, they will be dragged down again. Why? Because it's just a few lifetimes of doing positive merits. So by the time they finish school and they've been influenced the wrong way, they'll be dragged down. They'll be dragged down. So are we actually loving our kids or forcing our projections on them or what we feel will make them happy or what they should or should not do? We have to think. That's the truth. So therefore, spiritual practice is not the 1 hour on the cushion or meditation or mantras or sadhanas or making offerings. It's the 23 hours after the cushion. How we act, how we think, what we do. And don't write it off like, oh, I'm a good person. I'll just be a good person. No. If you're a good person, if you truly are a spiritual person, you will have control of your death and where you go. And you will be able to influence the people around you. When you talk about spiritual practice, how many people can you influence? That will test your powers. When you talk about spiritual practice, if you can't influence your wife and your husband, it is still exactly the same. How spiritual do you think you are? If you're not even sure if your children grow up spiritual now, how influential are you? How influential you are is how much spiritual energy and power you have. How much spiritual energy power you have is how much time you spent on it. So how much you can influence others towards spiritual practice is dependent on your practice. Your practice is dependent on knowledge and education. Education, knowledge will be based upon your realization of your mortality. So the first subject of Lama Tsongkhapa's great exposition to enlightenment, the great exposition, we should all get that, or in short, it's called Lam Rim. The great exposition to enlightenment, the first subject is what? Death and impermanence. Why do you think? Because Lama Tsongkhapa was morbid like me. He had nothing better to do but look at bones. Why is the first subject in the great exposition to enlightenment treasured and put on top of the head of high lamas in Tibet? The first subject is death and impermanence. Why? Spiritual practice can only become real when we realize our death. Otherwise, it's just a farce. When people are dead, it's said that to place the Lam Rim on their head will help them to take rebirth. That's how holy it is. Why? It contains the essence of all the Lord Buddha's teachings condensed. And a statue or a Dharma book is much more holier than a statue. Much more. Why? A Dharma book, Buddha's words, when we read and study, can take us to enlightenment. A statue at this level cannot. So why wait till you're dead and then someone comes and slaps a Dharma book on your head? Read it now. Practice it now. Why be so petty and minuscule and small-minded and like a village kampung auntie? Just food, 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 fun, movie, movie, entertainment, and that's all you talk about. Why be a village auntie with just such a narrow mind? Open. I have to open. So Dharma practice is what? If you do your Dharma practice correctly, you do your Dharma practice well, it will be a beautiful relationship with Setra. The real Dharma protector, according to Lord Buddha, is the reliance and trust in cause and effect. That is the real Dharma protector. The real one. Why? If a Dharma protector can actually affect or give us or hand us enlightenment, it would contradict what Lord Buddha had said, that enlightenment is in your hands. No one can give you enlightenment. But a Dharma protector's function is what? Is to push you and help you and to get the necessities for you that you can actually do the Dharma practice. Not do it for you or substitute it for you. No. That's very important. Now,